Vox Markets podcast with Justin Waite.
The people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Don't buy anything based solely on tip or recommendation you hear. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 623. It's the 28th of October, 2016. On the podcast today, I have Dr. Steve Staley, CEO of Upland Resources, UPL ticker. Now, Steve talks about progress at Hardstoff. It's a license they have at the moment, 25% share of that, and their strategy in acquiring other assets. And I quite like what Steve is doing. I do hold shares. I've written a blog about them. I like Steve, the board members, the assets they've got, and what he intends to do. Now, Steve is a very measured man, very sensible. And this is Steve sounding excited. So, it's worth listening and maybe putting it on your watch list, because I believe they are destined for bigger, better things under Steve's sort of guidance there. Also on the podcast, I have Nick LeDuc, technical analyst, looking at the following charts. Uru Metals, that's URU, I don't know if it's pronounced Uru. Seeing Machines, Sky, EasyJet, and Prospects Oil and Gas. We also touch on Barclays. Ooh, misses. I also have Simon French, chief economist of Panmure Gordon, talking about the GDP figures, France, conference in consumers, everything macro you need to know. Simon talks about it right here. Plus, I also have top five most followed companies on the Vox Markets website in the last 24 hours. Of course, these are companies popular at the moment. It's a sort of measure of money flow. People following these companies generally go on to do some more research, and hopefully, if the research turns out good, they invest. So I've got the top five there. I think there's a new number one, new number two, I know that, and three, and four, and five, actually. Plus, I have the top five most liked RNSs on the Vox Markets website this morning. This is news out today, and people hitting the thumbs up button there. And finally, I also have today suggested one for your watch list. It is Westminster Group, WSG ticker, been submitted by Investment Lady. Yeah. And listen, I'll give you the reasons why Investment Lady reckons you should add Westminster Group to your watch list in a bit.
The Vox Markets podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Dr. Steve Staley, CEO of Upland Resources. Steve, thanks for coming back on.
Pleasure.
I like to put the doctor in there. It gives you a formality. It shows you know something, Steve, you know?
Well, thank you very much. I like to think so. that's very kind of you.
But I mean, if anyone looks at your track record, they know you know something. You've been involved with some of the most exciting sort of oil and gas plays on the junior market in the last 10, 15 years. But as far as Upland is concerned, Steve, if anyone didn't hear the last podcast and they haven't read my blog about Upland, can you sort of give us a summary as to what you're all about, please?
Yes. We are an oil and gas exploration and production company. We are relatively new. We floated almost exactly a year ago on the main market. We're a standard listing. We raised about £1.3 million at 1p, and we are now at about 1.38p a year later. Our market cap is approximately £3 million. We have one asset, which I'll talk about a bit, perhaps a bit later. We still have about £900,000 cash in the bank, no debt, very supportive cornerstone investors, and are well along the road to realising the goals of our strategy.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I've got to say, for the interest of transparency, I hold stock in the company, and this came about. I held stock, and I was going through my portfolio, looking to sell stuff essentially. Right? And I had to there. I was on a little bit of a gain, not as much as I was previously, but a couple of months previous. And I thought, I'll sell some Upland. And then I did some more research. And I thought, hang on a sec, this is looking quite interesting. I looked at your background, I looked at the directors, and I thought, there's something happening here that I'm quite interested in. I mean, the fact that you've been involved in some exciting stories. So at the moment, let's say where you are at the moment. You are with Hardstoff, and eventually, the oil and gas. So how does this work, Steve? I know you applied for that and was awarded it, weren't you, last year, wasn't it?
Yeah, the Oil and Gas Authority announced the future award, if you like, of all of the blocks that have been included in the 14th onshore licensing round in, I think it was December last year.
Yeah.
But then not just us, but all the people who've won these blocks have had a wait, really, essentially until the summer. when the government got round to finally awarding them. So yeah, that happened towards the end of the summer, but which was great news. We've got hold of the asset now, but we also at about the same time increased our stake in Hardstaff from 16.7% to 25%. And that was due to the necessary withdrawal of one of our partners, Shell Petroleum, who from all of their UK assets, so that they could concentrate on their core assets in Canada and the US, and really, I guess, as part of the overall problems that the oil industry is having. But ourselves and Europa, one of our other partners in Hardstaff, we're very pleased to increase our stakes to 25%, and because we have INEOS in there as the third partner with 50%, and we are concentrating our particular group, ourselves and Europa, on the conventional prospectivity of Hardstaff, whereas INEOS, although they're in that with us as well, are also, of course, looking more at the unconventional.
Yeah, and when I looked at that Hardstaff, I thought it was quite interesting because, like I said, it's one of the first oil fields, wasn't it, to be drilled, and but I was looking at the high, you know, percentage chance of success. So you get 80% chance for contingent resources, 64% for prospective resources, which is very high. And essentially, what is it to you? Estimated 1.6 million barrels there. And so this here is quite a safe in terms of oil. It's quite safe, isn't it?
Yeah, relatively speaking. I mean, obviously, this being oil and gas, until you drill the well, you cannot be absolutely certain. But that's a very good chance of success. And that's because Hardstaff has been drilled before, and it has produced oil. Yeah. And that obviously removes a lot of the risks from this. We know that there's a working petroleum system, that there's a working oil field there. Now, what we've done since the days when this field was discovered, which was, 1919, this is Britain's first proper oil field. What we've done is remap it, ourselves and Europa and John Nicholson of Highland Geology. And we worked out a couple of things. We think that the technology that was used to drill those wells is clearly not the best. I mean, things have moved on a long way since 1919. They're simple vertical wells, and they would have missed the natural fractures in the limestone that is the reservoir rock here. These fractures tend to be approximately vertical. So if you're drilling a vertical well, chances are you'll miss them because they're not everywhere. Mm. You will produce some oil from what's called the matrix of the rock. And what is interesting about the main producing well in Hardstaff is that it continued to produce oil, small volumes for 5 years with no water. So it's sucking it out slowly, but it wasn't seeing any water. So we think a well that goes down vertically and then turns horizontal and picks up a lot of these vertical fractures will have much, much better production volumes. And, we think also that the volumes are could be larger. These are, when you're looking at the central case there, when we talk about the 6.75 recoverable from Hardstaff and Hardstaff East. So yes, there's a lot of potential there.
Yeah, but this, like I said, this is when I was reading, about into your reports and stuff. This seems like almost step one in a several step strategy. Is that the case?
Yeah, no, that's right, Justin. Our overall strategy here is initially to put in place a couple of assets that will give us either immediate production revenues or near-term production revenues, near-term in the case of Hardstaff. And so we have that. We need to do some more work on it before that can be re-drilled and hopefully put into production. But we're also well advanced with some other acquisitions. I can't be specific, unfortunately, that will add to that and give us, with Hardstaff, a fairly near-term substantial revenue flow. Now, that's not the end goal in itself. We're also pursuing the second phase of the strategy, and we've already started this because the lead times are always in oil and gas quite long. We're starting to identify the much bigger potential, although somewhat higher risk, more exploration-like assets to go into the portfolio. And this is, we've mentioned before where we're looking. We're focusing on onshore Morocco, and Malaysia. Not exclusively, but those are our main areas of focus. And we, in doing so, we for a number of reasons, but, and we're playing to our strengths in choosing those particular regions.
Yeah, and I was looking at another thing that interests me. I mean, what you said in your half your report, I think, you said, you focus on Malaysia and North Africa and stuff. And also, you have a massive connection as far as, the border is concerned in the Far East. I mean, you've got the chairman there holding just under 30% of the shares.
That's right.
Yeah, you own about, I think it's over 7%. And so who else is there? Is it, I'm afraid to even attempt to pronounce the names, but the other guys on the board as well are also big shareholders.
Yes, no, that's right. I mean, between the directors, I think we own about 38.5% of the shares. So we have, to use that awful phrase, a lot of skin in the game. Mm. And so, we're obviously very aligned with the other shareholders in our desires for the success of the company. Our Malaysian directors, our chairman is Norza Zakaria, and he is very experienced, very successful Malaysian businessman, very well connected in Malaysia, but also he has direct experience of the international oil industry. He worked at a very high level for Petronas, the Malaysian state oil company, for many years, but also another development since the last time we spoke is the appointment of Bolhassan D as a director of the company. Bolhassan, similarly, very experienced and successful businessman, but also experienced in the international oil industry as a UK educated engineer in the oil industry, and he worked at a high level for Shell, both in Malaysia and around the world. He's from Sarawak, which is the other part of Malaysia, not peninsula Malaysia, and his connections are very good there. He sat for several decades as a member of parliament in Sarawak, and he was for a period of time the deputy minister for infrastructure. So we have very good connections there, and we intend to make use of them, and I hope that we will be able to find opportunities that wouldn't normally be available to a company of Upland's size.
Yeah, so how did you make these connections? How do you know these guys?
It's a small world in the end, and through common commercial interests and common acquaintances, and you put together you put together a company that brings together the skills that are necessary, and the same goes for our technical team, which also covers all the bases, and it comes from, I suppose, being in the industry for well over 30 years.
Okay, so time frame wise now, as far as hard stop is concerned, what's the next thing to happen there, and when will it happen?
Okay, the first step with Hardstoft will be the acquisition of some new seismic, 2D seismic data over the Hardstoft structure. That should be happening early next year, possibly. It depends on the availability of seismic crews, and it depends on discussions with our partners there. So that's the next step on Hardstoft.
Yeah, okay. And then, I mean, I wrote in my blog, I wouldn't be surprised by this time next year that you have three assets producing. Was that a wild guess, or do you have an aim in that? I mean, like you said, you've got a strategy here of maybe building two very relatively safe cash generative assets, then going for some bigger plays and a bit more risky. But do you have any kind of number of assets in mind, or is there a strategy there? Is it that focused?
The strategy is focused, but we wouldn't tend to go for a fixed number of assets, but more that to make sure that we've got the right quality of assets there, producing the level of revenues that we would wish for. So revenues at a level that obviously cover our day-to-day running costs, but also give us extra to be enable us to go out and do some of these bigger things without having to worry too much about looking for additional fundraisers. We're well advanced in that strategy, as I say. Unfortunately, I can't be too specific about it, but we're very encouraged.
Excellent. Okay, so what is the ultimate ambition for Upland Resources, Steve? So, you know, I mean, looking on say a time here, a 5-year time horizon there, where would you like to be in 5 years' time? Size of the company, what would you like to be, you know, what assets would you like to have?
Well, our ultimate goal is to make our shareholders wealthy, Justin. So that will be what is at the top of our agenda all the time. And we will not be prescriptive about exactly where we would want to be, other than that we will have made them much more wealthy than they currently are.
Well, I'm pleased with that, being a shareholder. But do you envisage a size of a company or share or anything like that?
Yeah, well, certainly in terms of size, in 5 years, we plan to be much larger than we are now. We don't have a specific number in mind, but I would be disappointed if we were not very substantially larger in terms of market capitalisation than we are now.
Okay, all right. Marvellous. So next bit of news we can expect, where will it be coming out? Will it be about hard stuff, do you think? I mean, obviously, I'm trying to push you in the corner here. You can't reveal too much, but is it likely to be hard stuff? Is it likely to be something else?
It could be either, Justin, and I can't say, but I hope that to be able to say something about one of those in the near future, let's put it that way. I don't think I can be more specific than that.
Marvellous. All right, well, Steve, what I always like to do, I mean, at Vox here, on the podcast here, I do highlight the top 5 most followed companies on the Vox site every day in the last 24 hours. And to get on that list, basically, you have to have people following you, hitting the follow button on Vox. And so, if you could you give 3 reasons why someone should hit that follow button on Upland Resources page, please?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think we have a very bright future. We have been working diligently over the last year since we were floated, not only to get hard stuff into the company as an asset, but at the same time to get these other assets in there as well. And this is all moving forward very well now. So I think in terms of share price, I hope. That's one good reason. I hope it will continue to move upwards like it has done steadily. Mm-hmm. Second reason is more general one, if you like. We are very leanly run, so our overheads are tight. They're slightly larger last year than we used to because we had all the costs of the IPO, of course. But we don't pay ourselves a lot. We are focused entirely on getting this company to grow. And, you know, as I said before, the directors have about 38.5% of the share. So we are very incentivized by that. And thirdly, you know, I think this is, we are undertaking this strategy, this particular strategy, at this particular time because of the state that the industry is in. Hopefully, we've judged the flood in the affairs of man, as they say, and picked it up as the tide goes up. So we've been acquiring things like Hardstuff and hopefully some of these other assets at a time when oil prices have been historically low. It looks now, as far as anyone can tell, as if oil prices are starting to firm up and to move upwards. So I think, hopefully, as a company, we've picked just the right time to be putting into effect this particular strategy of acquiring assets that are in or close to production, and then also getting involved in some of the bigger, riskier projects slightly afterwards. And I'd say that, yeah, it's a subsidiary point to the third one, if you like, that we've been very careful to choose where we get those assets from. In other words, which countries they sit in. We're very aware of country risk, political risk, and we like to make sure that we're only doing these projects in countries that we are very comfortable in, and we know that we will be paid for the oil or gas that we produce.
Marvellous, Steve. Lovely to chat to you. And I look forward to that news coming out so we can chat some more, whatever it is, hard stuff or somewhere else, in the not-too-distant future. Steve, speak soon, fella.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
Joining me on the podcast right now is the lady with the technicals, the Duchess of the Chat, the Fibonacci's. You're right, Nick. How are you?
Hello. Yeah, really good. Thanks.
It's Nick LeDuc, by the way. Good. And now, what's your thoughts on the markets, Nick?
Well, you know, seasonally, the next 4 days are some of the most bullish of the year, which is going to be quite fun because everyone seems to be really bearish and in a rush to sell and election fever. So I think we could see strong stocks for and strong dollar for a couple of days more.
Okay. Seasonally. I don't know what that song is. Right. Okay. So let's look at the charts of the stocks selected by people who submit them to us via social media, etc., etc. So I sent you the list. Take it away. I can't see the list. I don't know where it's gone. So I sent it to you. But what were we starting with?
Uru Metals.
Oh, yeah. URU. Yes. Let's get my chat up. So how is this looking on the chat?
Okay, URU has made a very nice bullish reversal, mm-hmm. but it is at resistance or testing resistance at 0.91. So it's really only a buy if it clears 0.91. Where does 0.91 come from? Well, that's the highs in May. That was the high in August, and that was almost high. So it's kind of one of those levels. It's also the 23.6 Fibonacci retracement from the most recent swing high, mm-hmm. which was the 2014 high. So that's on a weekly chart you get that resistance from. So 0.91 is really quite important. 0.5 is support. That's back to the 20-week moving average. So I think it'll stall here. It's overbought on the weekly, but if it comes back to 0.5, it's a great buy.
I see. All right. So that's URU or URU.
Looks good. Now, in the alternative, if I'm wrong and it's just going to keep going, a daily close above 0.911 is a buy trigger as well. So back to 0.5 to buy or a daily close above 0.91.
Marvellous. All right. Lovely.
Otherwise, we're in the chop zone. Yes. Next one is Seeing Machines again.
All right. It's very popular. It's suggested it every week almost. And this was suggested several times this week. So C is the ticker. C. What do you reckon?
Had a really good rally, made a new yearly high, and it's come back to test the summer high. So it's sitting on support. It's sitting on the 200-day moving average as well, which, you know, the last time it cleared the 200 moving average was in 2014, mm-hmm. and it did it in kind of very overbought conditions. Mm-hmm. This time we've got above it and we've come back and we're just sort of sitting on it. I would say a daily close above 4.7 is a buy trigger in Seeing Machines. The RSI said we might kind of hang around for a few days before we get our, you know, our buy trigger. We've got a little bit further to come back. Yeah. But yeah, if it does and then it'll pop, it'll have another leg higher. Mm-hmm. It looks good.
Marvellous. Let's see. What's the next one, Nick?
I just want to say, because people always ask me to target that Seeing Machines, if it goes from here, will go to that next resistance at 8.35.
Lovely. So, all right. One. Okay. And the next is
Sky PLC.
Yes. Well, listen, I suggested this to you because I have no idea what's going on with you, other than, you know, being very basic and saying, listen, it's a tested, a really round £8 figure, and it's bounced off it. And
exactly.
I'm on the chart there. I'm trying to find what's going on here. I've drawn so many lines on my chart that it's just become ridiculous.
Okay. So, you know, markets, when they make impulsive moves, will make five waves. They'll make three waves in the trend direction and two corrections. And when they make corrective moves, they'll make three waves. So two down. So what we've seen is two equal legs down from that high in August in Sky, an ABC correction. So if it is bullish and if it is going to try harder, this is 800, 790. 800 is the level it's going to do it from. So we had a big, you know, bullish reversal candle. We've retraced 50% of it, which puts us at about 808. There's a really good chance that Sky keeps going here, because it did on the RSI as well, on the daily, came all the way down to the bottom and it turned up. So I would say Sky has a really good chance. And you're wrong below 788.
But oddly, I've drawn a line down from the highs, a channel trend line down from the highs of, when was that? In the 10th or the 4th of March, that high it made, which was like 927, all the way down across the tops there. And literally, it did hit its head on that yesterday. It had a nice strong day, hit its head on that today, and come below that. And now I've got a line drawn from the lows way back in, on the 24th of June. And, the high was on the 10th, sorry, the 6th of the 10th.
I know the trend line you mean, yeah. It's got to break that, you know, but what you want to look at getting above is that September low. So that September low is at 820.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah. And that's where the big rally this week stalled at 820. Yeah. So if you don't want to pick a pullback level to buy, a daily close above 820 is also a good buy signal.
Okay, lovely stuff. That's Sky. And what's the next one, Nick?
And the next one is EasyJet.
Okay, yes. So this is another sort of popular big stock. Of the big stocks that are popular, this is one of those. EasyJet. I was in and out of this, got my 10%, and it really fell, you know, it just fell through the floor then. And now it's down at 9. I bought at £10, sold at £11.20, and then it went, all of a sudden, just after that, it went a bit higher, then came all the way back down to below £9, and now it's at £9.31. So is this, yeah. I think it's formally a bottom here, isn't it?
No, I think it could. Ooh. I think there's a good chance that it goes to about 8.10.
Really?
8.20, yeah. Really? I think it needs another leg, yeah. Okay, so here's... I'm sorry. I know you want to like... I'd like to like it too. Okay, if it closes above 9.48, look, it's stalled at the gap. So we've got that Brexit gap, yes, and that highs, and it tried to get above and it couldn't. Like, and that's also the daily 20 moving average. It's made a three-wave rally that we just talked about. So that the rally is a correction and the trend is lower. So there's a real risk that it makes one more leg lower, and that will take us to about 8.15, 8.30.
Okay, all right.
So the only way you can say, okay, it's going to keep going higher, is if you get a close above the 20 moving average or a close above that gap, which would be sort of 9.55. Mm-hmm. If you can close in there, then we can say we've bottomed. And the daily 20 moving average is sort of 9.40. So it's got to close above that. Otherwise, no, the trend is still lower and it doesn't look great yet. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to pick great levels to buy, you know, 8.15, 8.20 is a great level to buy.
Okay, all right. And the last one. That's all right. And the final stock. What is it, Nick?
I couldn't find one. This is so bad. I couldn't find one I like apart from Barclays, which we talked about before.
Yeah.
So I like Barclays and the tiddler in the people everybody likes, the tiddlers. Prospects Oil and Gas is a really... has made a really nice correction, and I think it's on its way again higher.
Okay, so, well, I like that. I'm actually in Prospects Oil and Gas, so PXOG, I'm in that. So yeah, so it's had a bit of a pullback, but they're starting to see a bit of action there on the November the 7th thing. Is they're drilling the drill pad, ready to drill. So yeah, it's seen it's come back, the 2.5 pence a little bit.
Yes, it's come back, and if we close up here, you know, it'll be the highest close of the year. So
oh yes, good point, Nicholas. Yeah. Well spotted there. I like
so
that.
In the big ones, I like Barclays. In the small ones, I like Prospects Oil and Gas.
Okay, let's have a quick look at Barclays. Okay, Barclays. Okay, yes, it's looking nice, isn't it? I mean, you've got the 50-day moving average crossing.
Just made a new yearly high. Mm. So it needs to come back to that support. So it's going to could come back to about 185. Or 187 would be a good buy entry, because it is really quite overbought here, but it's definitely a buy dip stock. This one, it's proved it's bottomed.
Marvellous. Now, could I ask you a big favour, Nicola? Could you send me the annotated charts of the chart of the stocks we discussed, please?
Okay.
Oh, that would be marvellous.
Just this week.
Okay. Thanks, Nick. Okay. Have a lovely weekend. Speak next week.
Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Wade.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Simon French, Chief Economist at Panmure Gordon. Yeah, Simon, how are you? You're all right?
Morning, Justin. Very well, thank you.
Yes, lots of little figures out. I said little, some big, actually, the last few days. Now, first and foremost, I suppose the biggest one last few days was the GDP figures. Beat analyst expectations, were up 0.5%. They expected up 0.3%. So it looks good, didn't it?
Exactly. Brexit, what Brexit? It's one of those data releases which was feverishly anticipated. And you're right, it came in above market expectations, which was for growth of 0.3%. It came in at 0.5%, really dominated by the services sector, which accounted for all of that growth and more, because the other parts of the economy, agriculture, construction, manufacturing, was all in contraction. Mm-hmm. So a fairly lopsided number, but actually a good number in terms of the momentum the UK economy has sort of heading into into quarter four. And, you know, together with consumer confidence data out this morning and looking ahead to next week's inflation report from the Bank of England, it presents an economy that's in fairly rude health.
Yeah. And so what's, and also another bit of good news was, you know, the first Nissan plant are now going to continue to produce cars there up in the north, and with a new model added. So I was watching the news last night, I saw this, and they said what's not clear is whether the government has offered some kind of deal to Nissan and all that. Do we know anything about that, or what's happening there?
Well, we can be fairly confident the government did provide support. Whether that was explicit in terms of pounds and pence, or whether that was a commitment to offset any impact should Nissan going forward face tariffs to export into the European Union, that bit is unclear. But I would be very, very surprised, given what we've heard in recent weeks about the engagement between Nissan and the government, that there hasn't been a promise going forward for what you would describe as equivalence in terms of the economic situation Nissan will have to face when producing the Qashqai, which is the model they announced they were going to produce in Sunderland. They want to make sure that they aren't unduly affected by the potential for tariffs on exports into their biggest trading partner, because what we also had alongside the Q3 GDP data yesterday was car production in the UK, which was broadly flat year on year, but has been a big success story in the last, certainly since the crisis. But underlying that data was the fact that 78.6% of all cars produced in the UK are for the export market. And that really tells you everything you need to know about how important it is for those producers to get assurances from government that we're not going to take a more protectionist stance going forward post-Brexit, and they're going to be faced by additional costs.
Yeah, I'm just imagining Theresa May on the floor holding on to one of the Nissan boss's legs saying, please don't leave, we need you.
Well, the one thing I would say if I was advising Theresa on this one is that she has a slightly stronger argument than she did the day after Brexit, because, of course, sterling has fallen by about 15% since that date. And, of course, for Nissan producing cars in the UK, that has suddenly become significantly cheaper for their European buyers to buy British. Mm. And, of course, if they just maintain their prices in euro terms, those would be even more valuable in sterling terms. So, of course, you know, while there is the threat of tariffs going forward, there is also a significantly better terms of trade for Nissan producing in the UK. So she can probably point to that as a reason not necessarily to have to offset everything that Nissan may face.
Yeah, and there is that argument that I've heard quite a lot, saying people say, well, there's no point even worrying about tariffs because, you know, that the negative or positive of that will be wiped out by, you know, currency movement anyway. So you can see that going forward, you know?
And there is a little bit of mileage to that, but the caution I would have is that Nissan also sources some of its intermediary products that it puts into the supply process from overseas, and some of the raw materials, plastics, metals, those prices are made on the international market, which of course are denominated almost exclusively in US dollars, and we get less US dollars for our pound. So it won't be a one-for-one improvement in the terms of trade because of some of the input costs that will also go up. But undoubtedly, I think as Ben Broadbent, the Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, said last week, sterling is acting as a shock absorber for the UK economy, and it's certainly a shock absorber for Nissan.
Yeah, it seems to, it does seem to work in that way. But so I mean, looking forward there, I mean, I saw some other news there about consumer confidence. You know, are we broadly now more optimistic, you know, or less since the vote? Because I've seen so many conflicting bits of data coming out. I mean, where are we at the moment? I mean, what is going on?
Yes, I'll give you the authority if I can on this, Justin, which is that the consumer confidence and the purchasing managers index, those PMIs that came out in July straight after the vote, were clearly impacted by the shock factor. Even people who wanted to leave the European Union most of them really didn't expect that to happen. So when you ask people questions, how do you feel, there is an element of, oh, hang on, this has happened, and they will pare back their levels of confidence, their plans for the future. But then when the dust settled into August and September and now into October, lots of businesses and households have looked around and go, well, nothing actually has changed. And all we've really heard from the government is that Brexit means Brexit, and we can't really make any sense of that. So there is an element of, well, in the absence of a clear steer of what's going to happen when we leave the EU, we're going to carry on regardless. A little bit of a knock to confidence, a little bit of knock to the PMIs, but overall, not hugely dissimilar to where they were in Q1 and Q2 of this year.
Yeah, and I find generally, you know, we did have that date, you know, of the vote that everyone says will fall off a cliff after that. But, you know, life isn't like that, and everything, business, and anything, is a slow evolution, isn't it, towards change. It doesn't just generally change overnight. So whereas people are expecting this massive change straight away, that doesn't happen. Never does. You've got years, you know, to adjust.
You're right. And I think also some of your listeners will be going, but we had these warnings of an emergency budget, we had these warnings of an immediate recession. So I'll give you how I would evaluate those. So clearly, some of those warnings were overdone, and I think history will judge some of the more draconian ones of an emergency budget, almost a punishment budget, as really too much of Project Fear. But the longer-term warnings, the ones that came from the IMF, the ones that came from a lot of the research organisations, we simply won't know for, I think, as I said on this podcast previously, the best part of a decade as to whether they were right or wrong. Now, that, of course, doesn't fit with the 24-hour news agenda, but unfortunately, it's the right way to measure whether those warnings of the damage Brexit could do to the UK economy will be true or false.
Yeah, what's that term you used for a while back? It wasn't Brexit. You put two words together.
Brexit. We are Brexit. Yes.
Yeah.
That word, it didn't quite catch on, but we could try and restore it, couldn't we? But we are certainly in Brexit conditions, and if we think about March 2017 as the timetable the government's working towards to trigger Article 50, and then it's another 2 years after that until we actually leave the EU, you could argue that the earliest real data point we get for what the impact will be on the UK economy won't be until the summer of 2019, some long way off before some of those warnings and indeed promises are tested.
Yeah, I was trying to think of the actual term for that. Portmanteau, isn't it? But I was going to say, do you know what? Maybe you should have a new one called Brexit Lag, so we call it Brag, because that's the lag of the Brexit.
I like that.
Yes.
I'm going to put that in the research note on Monday morning, see whether it catches on.
Cool. Anything else you've been looking at, Simon, quickly?
Yeah, so quickly over the channel into France, and there was GDP data out this morning showing a modest expansion of 0.2% quarter on quarter, so that's somewhat lower than what the UK enjoyed.
Yes.
Unfortunately, the French economy's got a couple of headwinds it's dealing with right now. Let's list them as three quite quickly. Clearly, it's locked into the European single currency, which is too strong for the French economy. And although Mario Draghi's trying his best to weaken it, it isn't quite supporting the French economy to the same degree as it really needs. second headwind, of course, is those horrendous terrorist attacks. They've really damaged the French tourist industry and just general confidence to go out and shop and be in communal areas. And the third area, of course, is political risk, because, of course, we face a French general election in the middle of 2017 with uncertainty over whether the incumbent, François Hollande, who's very unpopular, will retain the presidency, or whether Alain Juppé or indeed Marine Le Pen might seize the Élysée Palace, and what does that mean for the trajectory of the French economy. So uncertain times in our nearest European partner, and struggling to get unemployment down below that crucial 10% level.
Yeah, do you know, in the world of finance, though, there's always uncertain times. That is the only certainty, isn't it? There is uncertainty, that's it. And so we should almost get used to it and be blasé about it a little bit, because it's always there, you know?
You make a fair point in terms of the pushback on the fact there's political uncertainty. I think just the fact that the French economy is facing that perfect storm of both political uncertainty, which, you're right, is almost always there in some guise, but also a structural problem of deeply inflexible labour markets and a European single currency that isn't working for it, plus an unfortunate set of circumstances associated with the public security concerns that are limiting, you know, consumer confidence as business confidence, given the spectre of those terrorist attacks.
Yeah, well, they should leave the EU. That would help them. All right, so thanks very much. Have a nice weekend, fella.
You too, Justin.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on the Vox Markets website in the last 24 hours. At five, Colin, the CEO, was on yesterday. Ascent Resources, AST, at four. They were suspending yesterday. Shock announcement. Really, RNS came out and just suspended the stock. They're looking into that. That's Management Resource Solutions. Of course, I've had them on the podcast. That's a ticker. Mrs. is the ticker there. At three, New Oil and Gas. That's New OG. NUOG. At two, URU Metals. URU. And at number one, I think it was there yesterday as well. And it was a previous 2 days ago, I think it was suggested as a stock on one for your watch list by somebody, by Avsal, that's right. And it's done well, I think. The day after, it did very well. That's Oxford Pharmascience, OXP. All right, top five most liked RNSs on the Vox Markets website this morning. At five, Milestone Group. They've announced the launch of Alchemy TV. At four, Metal Tiger, MTR, Botswana, encouraging extension and infill drilling results. At three, Ferrum Crescent, notice of AGM. I don't know why that got so many likes. At two, Talao Energy, operational report, quarter ending the 30th of September. And they highlight there all the positive things going on there. And number one, the most liked RNS on the Vox Markets website this morning is Andalas Energy and Power final results. Now, a couple of people misread this. I'm just going to check where it started off down, really about 10% down or something like that. But buys have been coming through, and the sells are outweighing the buys this morning. But now buys are outweighing the sells. So as I'm looking, there's a 43 million buy volume, 27 or 28 million sell volume. And that was the other way around earlier on. And they're just 2% down now. But people misread this, and the cash. Because, of course, I'll go through this in the weekend podcast with Pete and Steve. But when you look at the final results, you have to realise that these are ended. Like, for example, I think Andalas was ended April the 31st. So anything that comes after that is not included. Sometimes they do a section called, you know, post-period results. And they'll highlight what they've raised since. So in the actual final results, it showed that Andalas had, I think £200,000 in cash in the bank. But since that, and that, it is in a section there, final results, of financial results, but, you know, after that, they raised 3.55 million. So that's not including the actual balance sheet. So you have to put that in as well and then sort of work out the cash burn by going by the loss. So that's the way to do it. We'll go through that in the weekend podcast. All right, today's suggested one for your watch list is Westminster Group, WSG, submitted by Investment Lady. What does the company do? Westminster Group, a highly experienced and internationally acclaimed fire safety, security and defence group operating worldwide through an extensive network of agents and international offices in 50 countries. The group consists of two internationally focused operating divisions providing a wide range of solutions and services. How much shares does the company have in issue? 87 million? Check that. Yeah, 87 million. Spot on, yes. What's the current price and market cap? Share price, 28 pence. Market cap, 24.3 3.9 million, so 24 million shares pretty much. What revenue, profit or loss did the company generate? In their interim results for 6 months ended 30th of June 2016, revenue was 2 million, loss 830K. Positive adjusted operating EBITDA level of 0.18 or 180,000, and operating loss reduced by 82% to 180,000 there. Average gross margin improved to 74%. How much cash or debt does the company have? In the interim results for 6 months, June, cash stood at £709,000. Borrowings stood at £2.5 million. On the 40th of July, they issued their final £210,000 of loan notes to Darwin Capital Limited. So list three reasons why people should put this company on their Vox Markets watch list. Number one, they have 7 memorandums of understandings in progress at the moment. Number two, they have 1 letter of intent for a transformational £35 million a year contract in the Middle East. Wow, £35 million a year. If that comes off, that would do very well. Because, I mean, if you look at the revenues, only, £4 million. So that would be transformational. And number three, they have a history of breakout RNSs. So this is a very good example. Thank you very much, Investment Lady, for bringing this to my attention, because at that point, number two there, that is worth adding this group, you know, to your watch list just to get the RNS, you know, because if that comes through, it's going to rise. And so, or keeping an eye on it, or just following them now, you know, and seeing what progress is going on. So it's WSG, Westminster Group, and of course, that to me, the standout there is that contract in the Middle East. Of course, listen, I'm taking Investment Lady's opinion on this. I don't know if it's true or not. I'm saying it's fact, because Investment Lady suggests. This is why you should always do your own research, you know? All I have is Investment Lady's word for this. I'm sure she's a lady, so she's accurate there, and she's honest. But this is why I have to do my own research. So WSG is Westminster Group. Thanks for submitting that. And thank you very much for listening. Muchos appreciatos.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.